The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 629 for Sunday, October 30th, 2016.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We share your questions, we share your tips, we share your cool stuff found, which is what we did last week. All in the interest of ensuring that each and every one of us that attends or listens later learns at least four new things. Sponsors for this episode include Gazelle at gazelle.com, where you can sell off your old devices for cash, and you can buy refurbished devices, reconditioned, I should say, from Gazelle for less cash than you'd spend likely elsewhere. We'll talk more about that shortly. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
All right, John, we're going to dive right in. We're going to go to Chuck, because why not? Let's just get this thing rolling. And Chuck asks, he says, catching up on some recent Mac Geek Gabs, I've been listening for a definitive go before upgrading to Sierra from Yosemite. So a double skip there. I've been holding off waiting for a few iterations and updates, which we've seen. And your podcast topics haven't seemed to be dwelling on Sierra upgrade problems or post-installation glitches. Have I been listening carefully enough? Yeah, Chuck, good question. And I'm glad you asked. In a general sense, no. We haven't heard of any real major issues moving from, certainly not from El Capitan to Sierra. You didn't mention exactly which Mac you have. I think if you've got, I'm feeling like 8 gigs of RAM for both El Capitan and Sierra is sort of what Apple's target is for that. So if you've got less than 8 gigs of RAM, you may find some coming from Yosemite, you may find a little bit of sluggishness, especially on boot up or on wake up with your Mac with El Capitan or Sierra. But I don't find any difference between El Capitan and Sierra on a 4 gig Mac. But other than that, and then make sure most software and hardware works just fine going to Sierra. But there are a few things, especially, like USB audio devices. You need to make sure that you've got drivers for those that are specific to your OS. So just make sure that those exist before you upgrade, or make sure to clone off your Yosemite install in case you need to roll back to that. But in general, no, it's been very, very smooth for everyone that's gone through it. We really haven't heard a lot. So thanks for asking, though, because you're right. We haven't been dwelling on it. So I can see where you might have been wondering. So yeah, good stuff.
But if you wanted to dwell on it, you'd go to roaringapps.com, and they have a section about Sierra compatibility. And they'll also email you with updates.
Oh, no kidding.
Compatibility. Yeah, I just noticed that on their homepage here.
Hey, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, assuming that people aren't messing with them.
Well, yeah, right. Yeah, it's mostly crowdsourced, right? I think so. Yeah,
I would imagine. Yeah. But yeah, it tells you compatibility. So yeah, to flip through that and just make sure.
Just make sure. Yeah, exactly.
The apps that are important to you.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Let me see. So they got 6,000. I was looking at it first, and I'm like, wait, they only have 10 apps in their database? No, they're only showing 10 at a time here.
Oh, okay.
But they have 6,757 apps or so cataloged for compatibility. So that's nice of them.
All right. So Mike has what we'll call a follow-up question, even though Mike didn't know he was doing that at the time. He says, I'm waiting a little while to upgrade to Sierra with a fish shake at Avid. Case in point. In the past, I've always done a nuke and pave before installing a new OS. It was to keep the cruft from building up year after year to start fresh. With the newer operating systems, is this still a concern? I'm sure we both have different feelings on this, but I feel like it's gotten better, but it's always going to be an issue at some level. And I find it's less and less about the operating system keeping cruft around, although it does, and more about what we as users do. Right, I wind up downloading a ton of different stuff, things that you folks suggest, things that I find. I test them out. I run them, And that stuff can get in the way or at least just pile up down the road. A nuke and pave lets you do away with all that and, you know, in one fell swoop. So my feeling is I tend to do, unless there's some problem, I tend to do normal, just over the top installs for a few years and then nuke and pave every maybe 3 or 4 years. It's often when I get a new Mac that I stop and think, you know, maybe it's time to do a nuke and pave or, you know, and just start from scratch. It's not as bad as it could be. It's not as bad as it used to be because you can typically download all the stuff that you need now. So I don't think you have to, but it's not a bad idea every few years. What do you think, John?
I migrate. I'm okay with it. Yeah. I just installed Sierra over the old thing on my MacBook Pro and everything seems fine. And the things that didn't work are the things I expected not to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do a clone before I upgrade, just because.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Right. Well, if you have to roll back, kind of for the reasons I mentioned before, it's just like there's something you didn't plan for that suddenly requires you to go backwards. Like, all right, go backwards. It's fine. No harm, no foul. So.
Yeah. I mean, what you may want to do every now and then, just as good practice, as you said, things build up. Because every now and then I'll go through my either my downloads folder. That's where most of the garbage, you know, I don't really pay attention to it. But one should. I mean, you could at the very least sort by date or at least sort by name and get rid of, you know, duplicates or use something like Clean My Mac,
I
believe, does that.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
You could either do it through the Finder yourself. It's not too hard. Or Clean My Mac makes it a little nicer.
Yeah. They've got a nice little database that sort of pays attention to that
stuff. And actually, even Sierra now, of course, has some features built in that kind of clean things up or put them elsewhere if they're taking up too much space.
Right. Right. That's right. Yep.
Yeah. I don't think it necessarily proactively whacks things. Though it'll empty, yeah, I think it can empty the trash automatically for you now.
Kevin Collins in our chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream, where you're welcome to join along anytime we are recording a show. Kevin Collins in the chat room says he suggests Hazel for weekly download archiving. And Hazel is great for this. It can do a lot of different things. I mean, it you can have it watch folders and do all sorts of different things. And I've used it for years. We use it to process our incoming files for Mac Geek Gab in ways. And it just, I mean, you can say, look, when something appears in this folder, go and do all this stuff. But you can also have it do things like archive off your downloads folder. I have it remove incomplete downloads after a week. I have it remove duplicate files because it might not come as a great surprise that I wind up downloading the same thing again for various reasons. And then I have two of them and Hazel will pitch the duplicate one. It's really, really cool. So yeah, thank you, Kevin, for suggesting that. Hazel is killer. So yeah, good stuff. Use Hazel, John?
Nah, I never got into it.
Yeah. It's one of those things that once you have it, it's pretty handy to have around. So, all right. And then one last one about migrating. John, Aaron writes, he says, I recently had to update my laptop due to my 08 black MacBook breathing its last few breaths. It was running 10.7.5 when it did. I decided to start clean and not do a migration, too many years of stuff. Everything's been going well, except for the migration of my email. Here is my process. I connect the hard drive from my old Mac to my new Mac via a dock. I opened mail on the new Mac and I tried to use mail to import the mailboxes on the other drive. However, it is unable to see the users/library folder that the mail folder is in. So with a little finagling, I take the mail/v2 folder from my old hard drive and move it to my new laptop. And then I choose to import. I found everything is fine, except that it took 2 days and never finished. It completely hung on a deleted mail folder. I stopped the import, and after I had restarted mail, all my accounts were switched to read-only, and it appeared that my old data was there. I did some research and found that this read-only issue was a permissions thing. So I downloaded Onyx and ran some maintenance. Voila! All my imported folders were gone, and the read-only issue was resolved. I tried 3 permutations of this, though, including clearing the deleted mail folders, all with similar results. So I am left still needing slash wanting to get all of my mail from my old drive. Too much organization and information that I need. However, there must be a better way to get it into the newer version of mail without this hassle. Yeah. A couple of things. Number one, importing mail can be interesting at best. I've found it safer to just migrate all of my mail over. So even when I'm doing, or especially when I'm doing a manual migration, before I launch mail for the first time on a new machine, I copy my user's home library mail folder over to the new computer. And then when mail, it be it a new version or the same version, but if it's a new version, when it sees it, it will offer to re-index and kind of rebuild my mail library. But that I've found to be the best way. Now, in your case, it's probably too late for that, because you've probably been using mail on the new computer while trying to pull over all this old data. One thing I suggest is when you mount the old drive, go into the Finder, do a get info on the old drive. And from there, way at the bottom of the get info window is a checkbox that says ignore ownership on this volume. Check that. That should deal with all of the permissions issues that might or might not exist and might be the magic answer to your problem. It should at least get you further down the path and is certainly the next thing I would try. Do you have any other thoughts, John?
My thought is why any of this would even be necessary if you're using IMAP.
Well, if he's got an archive on his Mac, then it's absolutely necessary. Not all of it. I mean, I certainly don't have enough storage on my IMAP server to store all the mail that I have archived. So I archive it off. I think it's his on my Mac storage that we're talking about here. But you're right.
I'm scratching my head.
Yeah, no, you're
last
totally
time
right.
The last time I set up a computer from scratch, I'm like, okay, go to, you know, whatever system preferences where you'd find your internet.
Yep.
Things and, you know, may have to do some. Okay, actually, now I think I can understand part of the question.
Yeah, but no, you're right. If everything
that I had to manually fiddle with, I mean, the mailboxes certainly come over, but some of the lower level settings.
Yeah.
Or like if you have custom email addresses bound to ones, that may not make it over.
So, right.
Okay.
Right.
Just thinking through here, but yeah, actually, I have. I mean, all of my content is stored in IMAP. I don't have any that's just on my Mac.
No kidding.
I have, well, who is it? You know, Yahoo has a terabyte. So, you know, I have archive folders for all of the, I mean, you should have an archive folder.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's technically part of the IMAP standard, but I have archive folders on all of my various mail accounts. And when mail gets, you know, typically over a year, I take the mail from the primary mailbox and drag it over to the archive.
Right. But that you're still keeping all of that on the IMAP server as
correct.
Opposed to just a local archive. Isn't that interesting? I use Gmail and its various incarnations of Google Apps for domains and things like that. I never thought about using Yahoo as a secondary, you know, mail account that I never send or receive from necessarily, but use as an online archive. I mean, you have to choose to trust Yahoo with your email, and we won't get into that. Everybody's got security concerns. Yahoo, I think, just had a pretty bad one earlier this year. But yeah, that's interesting. I forgot that whole unlimited storage thing. That's not a bad idea if you trust Yahoo, you know, with whatever you've got in your email. That's not a bad idea. Huh. Yeah, I mean, in the chat room, Furby says that relying only on a host for backing up and preserving IMAP data is a bit risky, and I totally agree with that. But it's,
yeah,
you know,
that's why I do full backup.
Another layer of protection.
I have a mirror of it.
Right. Huh.
Now, the other strategy, I'm curious here. I'm running this on my other machine and not my podcast machine, but I mean, I wonder if Migration Assistant has these smarts to only bring over mail data.
Oh, yeah. That might be true.
I know it won't. Yeah, when you do Migration Assistant, at some point you get a level of granularity as far as what you'd like to bring over. And I believe you can just say mail.
Yeah.
And it's associated stuff. That would be another way to kind of avoid these permission.
Somebody in the chat room says migration assistant won't let you drill down that far. So
yeah, I thought it did at one point.
It might.
I guess
it doesn't anymore. Let's see. What are we going to here? Oh, yeah. All right. So, John, listener John, not you, although you might have had the same question, writes, he says, just curious if you guys have heard if the new Touch Bar that Apple announced this week for the MacBook Pros will be integrated into any external Apple keyboards so the functionality can be used with other devices. And I figure this is a good way to kind of slip ourselves into the discussion about...
was there an event?
About the Apple event, right. Well, and I had the same thought, John, about, Apple tends to do these types of things, right? When they announced the iPhone 6, at that same event, they announced the Retina iPad Mini 2, I believe. The iPhone 6 had a Touch ID sensor. The brand new iPad Mini did not. And I asked them about it, like, you know, why not? And they said, well, it was a very canned response that they had in kind of the demo room after the event. But it was look, you know, well, we feel that this is a good place for this to be used. And we're going to focus on it here for now. And my guess is if you ask them the same question about the Touch Bar, they would say the same thing. But eventually, of course, the Touch ID sensor sort of expanded throughout the product line. I would guess that the same thing is planned for the Touch Bar, but they're going to see how it goes and see how not only users react to it, but how developers react. Does it need to be tweaked? Does it, you know, is there anything that should change before it becomes, you know, part of every aspect of the keyboard centric product line? But there is an interesting thought, assuming that it's going to go there. I was having a conversation with Red Sweater Software's Daniel Jalkut on Twitter, and he pointed out very, very quickly that if they put the Touch ID sensor, which is a part of the Touch Bar, if they put the Touch ID sensor into an external keyboard, the Secure Enclave would likely also have to be inside that keyboard too. Others pointed out maybe not because... but it would have to be inside the Mac. So do you want to limit that? And, you know, then there's a secure connection between the keyboard and the Mac, much like there is between the watch and the iPhone. It starts getting interesting. My guess is they would put the Secure Enclave inside the keyboard and your fingerprints would be paired to that keyboard, not to that Mac, which is fine. I mean, it's kind of a different way to think about it, but fine nonetheless. So, yeah, I think they'll be coming. I think we'll see them probably in the spring would be my guess. But it's just a, you know, semi-educated guess. I have no information on that.
It's all about the mysterious T1 chip.
Is that what's in there?
Well, they at one point pointed out that there's this chip called the T1 chip that handles Touch ID and Secure Enclave.
Oh, okay. Okay, right. So
I thought it was kind of funny. T1, it's like, dude, that's like so 90s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, back in the 90s, if you wanted to have like the fastest internet connection, you get a T1. Now, that was 1.5 megabits per second synchronous. Yes. So
yeah, I remember that, man. That was great. I actually worked in a lab where we had our own T1. We were like rock stars.
Yeah. Now, even probably the slowest cable modem, even the slowest DSL connection is likely faster than a T1 in both directions. So, yeah, good stuff. Yeah. But let's talk about this event that Apple had. I mean, we don't need to recap everything, but is there any thoughts that you want to share, John, with the show here?
I mean, most of it was rehashing stuff that we knew already. I mean, they talked about TV. It's like, okay, that it's a, you know, it's a better way to manage what you want. Apple hardware and select services, and I think that's the kind of fish shake that some people have, is that it's not all encompassing, but that's kind of the nature of the landscape to begin with. So.
Right. I'm really excited about the TV app, by the way. You know, for months, I've been saying that the Apple TV is too app-focused. It's too app-centric. It makes sense for the iPhone to be app-centric because there are many, many different types of things that you can do with it and would do with it. on a daily basis. With the TV, while there are many different types of things that you might do on a daily basis, you're likely turning that on to consume content. So why do you ask me what app I want to launch every time I turn on the TV? Why is that the home screen? And while Apple didn't talk about solving that problem, they did talk about and create the user interface that would solve that problem. And it's called the TV app. You still have to launch the app, but once you're in, it shows you a list of your favorite shows, and it doesn't matter what app you need to run those shows as long as you have the app. But once you've started watching them, they all sort of appear there, and then you get some recommendations and all of that. Well, recommendations is, I'm glad Apple's doing it. Do I expect great things out of it? No, but that's not a fault. That's not a dig at Apple. That's just a dig at the industry in general. No one has done discovery well yet, I don't think. But I'm sure glad that Apple's going to try, and we'll see how that goes. But having a favorites list is great. Not having Netflix in there is a little weird, but it's just as weird as not having Amazon Prime on the Apple TV at all. You know, I already live this world, right? Because I have TiVo, I have a show-centric view that is multi-platform. And TiVo includes Netflix and Amazon Prime right in their views. So if I want to go watch Mr. Robot, I just choose Mr. Robot from my list of shows on the TiVo, which is sort of my main page there. And it plays it for me. And in fact, last night, I thought we were watching Mr. Robot on Netflix. We are not. We are watching Mr. Robot on Amazon Prime. And that's fine. But that was sort of the beauty of it, is I did not know. We just keep watching the episodes from...
Oh, you started watching. That's good.
Yeah.
Are you in the first season?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're at episode 1.6 or 1.7 or something. But yeah, that paradigm works. It's a little weird to me that Netflix is willing to participate in TiVo's implementation of this, but not Apple's, but we'll see how that goes. But I'm really excited about the TV app. I mean, it solves a huge problem with the Apple TV and paves the way. I'm hoping it becomes the default home screen for the Apple TV at some point, but that's not my call. So yeah, I was excited about that. And then new MacBook Pros, or is that new MacBooks Pro? How do we say that properly, John? I don't
MacBook
know.
MacBook Pros? I would say MacBook Pros.
All right.
It's the plural of MacBook Pro.
It's not MacBooks Pro?
No, that doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah, but neither does Attorneys General and yet.
Attorney Generals.
No, sir.
Mm-mm. Yeah, well.
Nope.
Well, I'm going to say what sounds right, not what's correct.
Okay. Anyway, now that we've gotten that not sorted out, what thoughts on the new MacBooks Pro, John?
They bumped the specs a little bit. You know, the touch bar is of course a big innovation there, which okay, that's kind of cool. It looks like they abandoned MagSafe. Though somebody already makes a MagSafe like thing for the connectors on there,
and yeah,
now
Griffin.
They got four. I saw that. So, now they got four Thunderbolt 3 ports. It's like, okay, that's kind of nice.
All right, so let's back up a little bit, because what you said is incorrect. They do not have four Thunderbolt 3 ports. They have four USB-C ports, and on this particular machine, because of the chipset and chip that's in it, those USB-C ports are capable of transmitting USB 1, USB 2, USB 3, Thunderbolt 1, 2, I believe 1, but certainly 2, and Thunderbolt 3, and power, right? So this is an important distinction here, because it's an easy mistake to make, and I blame the USB consortium for this. When we're talking about USB nomenclature, there are some letters associated with USB and there are some numbers. Here's the easy way to remember it. Letters describe shapes of connectors and nothing more. Numbers describe transport protocols. So USB-A is the flat connector that we're used to on almost everything that's existed, you know, for a while. USB-B is that square weird port, the thing that looks sort of like a house that's probably on your printer and perhaps nothing else. And then USB-C is the new connector that we're all seeing. USB 1, 2, and 3 just describe speeds and maybe a couple of other things. But our connector agnostic. Thunderbolt does not have connectors. Thunderbolt 1 and 2 operate over mini DisplayPort shaped connectors, and Thunderbolt 3 operates over a USB-C shaped connector. Does that help? It's confusing.
Thunderbolt 3 USB-C ports. How's that?
They are USB-C. Yeah. But that makes it sound like the Thunderbolt 3 is the shape of the port, and it's not. They're USB-C ports that will transmit Thunderbolt 3. Yeah. That will speak Thunderbolt 3. Yeah.
What I didn't say was incorrect. Maybe.
No. Well, specific. You call them Thunderbolt 3 ports, which is incorrect.
Well, that's what Apple calls them, too.
So. I know. That's the problem.
I'm looking right at the spec, and they say Thunderbolt 3, paren, USB-C.
Right.
Close paren.
Right. I know. Yeah.
But no, it's... I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily for me. I'd have to think about it. I mean, so it's nice that you have these, you know, potentially very speedy ports, and there's four of them. That's nice. Of course, now we're going to be talking dongle hell. You're going to need a dongle to do everything. Well, I can't say I miss some of the things that they don't include, like, you know, the SD slot I always found was a poor implementation. So, yeah, so what?
Right.
You need adapters for whatever else you need.
Right. Yeah, I really like the whole USB-C concept. I was sold on it at CES earlier this year, and it's good. I mean, it can handle all kinds of things, including power. So it's a very, very flexible port. I think it's a good thing. Yes, there's a transition that we're sort of already in the midst of going through here. And yes, that'll be somewhat painful. And yes, we'll have to live in dongle/dock world. But I really like, I mean, you know, I'm not using any USB-C stuff yet, so I don't have any USB-C docks, but I do have Thunderbolt docks on the two iMacs that I use regularly. I've got a CalDigit dock up here in the studio, CalDigit Thunderbolt dock, and then an OWC Thunderbolt dock down in the office. And they're both, I mean, it's great being able to have these extra ports. And like, this machine doesn't have USB 3, but it does now with this Thunderbolt dock. So I like the idea of this kind of dock expansion world. A little different with laptops, but like you said, dongles and adapters kind of get you there. So I use Thunderbolt on my MacBook Air to get me USB 3 and gigabit Ethernet. And I think that's great. So I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah. And the only thing that cracks me up, and I saw, I don't know who penned the article, but I saw we penned an article here. But I don't think the general public is asking for thinner each time. I understand the engineering challenge of making something thinner and make it do more. I mean,
sure.
Part of it is just, you know, what, you know, part of it is design, and part of it is, you know, vendors, you know, people that make the parts you put in there make things that are smaller. But
sure.
I don't know. Yeah. It seems to be a fixation. I don't know if you follow this one account on Twitter, but it's funny, but it's a Johnny Ive parody warning. He uses, he drops F-bombs all the time. But that account is so funny. It's somebody pretending to be Johnny, and the half the time he tweets about making everything thinner because it's like his obsession.
So here's something interesting, John, that John in the chat room pointed out to us, that on the MacBook Pros with the touch bar, so the ones with four USB-C ports. Apple keeps calling them Thunderbolt 3 ports, which is sort of weird. But on the 15-inch, all four of those ports deliver full Thunderbolt 3 performance. No problem. But on the 13-inch that has the touch bar, which has four USB-C ports, they all support Thunderbolt 3. The two left-hand ports support Thunderbolt 3 at full performance. The two right-hand ports deliver Thunderbolt 3, but have reduced PCI Express bandwidth. So if you get the 13-inch with four ports, The two left-hand ports are the ones that you want to use for speed-intensive operations. And then the 13-inch with only two Thunderbolt, sorry, the 13-inch with only two USB-C ports delivers full Thunderbolt 3 on both of them. And there's a knowledge base article about this, but I'm not sure. I mean, we could speculate as to why it's. I'm sure it's just engineering and design and all of that. But thank you, for, both John in the chat room and PowerBook dude. So, hey, I like my PowerBook too. My Pismo was one of my favorite machines. So,
yeah, I'm fine with the my 2012. Does everything I need.
Yeah. I'm so that's my only complaint about the event is I actually like what they've done with the new MacBooks Pro or MacBook Pros. I like the idea of the touch bar. I'm glad they're experimenting with it. But it leaves the rest of the lineup a little bit confused. Still, there's this, lower end 13-inch MacBook Pro that they set up to compete with the $500 cheaper MacBook Air at also at 13 inches. And then there's the MacBook at the low end of the range. There's no 11-inch Air anymore, but they didn't clean up the lineup in a way that makes it easy. Like I need,
well, I think Phil did. I mean, he basically said, I don't know why he didn't just say it. He said, what I heard him say when he was talking about the low end MacBook Pro was don't buy the MacBook Air.
Well, but except
did you hear the same thing?
Yeah. Well, I thought this was going to be one of those things where they say, and we still have the 13-inch MacBook Air for people that want that. And then he went down the path of explaining how the 13-inch MacBook Pro is better, faster, smaller than the Air with the same screen size. And I thought it was going to be, and so actually we're going to go ahead and drop the Air and we've just got this here for you instead.
Well, but, yeah, that's what I thought he was
going to say. But no, they left it because there's a $500 price delta between the two. That's not insignificant. So that's the part that kind of makes me scratch my head is like, all right, as a guy who knows that he needs to buy at least a couple of laptops for the family this year, we've been, the kids definitely need to be upgraded at some level at some point in the next, probably 6 months, if not sooner. Maybe I need a replacement for my 2011 Air. I probably need to spend a lot of money is what it is. I was waiting for this event so that I could decide which path to go down. And part of my path might be refurbs, right, of older models, which is totally fine. I just kind of wanted to see what was going to happen. And I'm just as confused as I was before going in, like, really, which ones do I get for the kids, that are going to last? I'm hesitant with the MacBook. I'm frankly hesitant with anything that's only got two cores right now, which is everything except the 15-inch Air. Or, sorry, the 15-inch Pro. So that's really where I'm just kind of frustrated. But, that's that. I got nothing else. So, yeah. So, I don't know. That's what I got, John. Hey, okay. Let's talk about our sponsor here because the folks at Gazelle know exactly what they're doing when it comes to taking your old devices. And that can be old Mac laptops in addition to your iPhone and your iPad that you're no longer using. And turning them into cash. They make it super simple. You just visit gazelle.com and start clicking. And you can do it. You will get a price before I finish doing this sponsorship spot for Gazelle. Because they make it so, so quick. You can do this on your iPhone. You can do it on your Mac. You can do it on your iPad, obviously. So you go there and you click and you tell it, I want to sell something, and they ask you what you want to sell in terms of a general product category. You drill down a little bit, answering some questions that get more and more specific as you as you identify what it is you're selling, and then you tell them what condition you think it's in, and they give you some guidance on that. And if it's and then they show you a price, and if you like the price, you say great, and they send you a box or a shipping label, whichever you like, however it works out best for you, and then you ship it in. You don't pay for shipping. You don't pay for anything. The only money that flows from them to you once they receive your device. And they're great about it. I just sold off an iPhone to them, I don't know, a month ago. And it worked out great. In fact, they got it. They had some questions about it. They emailed me before they did anything. They came back around and gave me actually a little bit more money for it than I thought or than it originally said I was going to get. And if you want, instead of getting the money as cash, if you take it as Amazon bucks, they'll add 5% to it. So if you're going to spend some money at Amazon, which this holiday season, I think is for many of us sort of a given, why not take the extra 5 points, spend it there. You're good to go. You got to check it out. Gazelle.com. On the way during your checkout, they'll ask where you heard about Gazelle. Go ahead and make sure that you you choose Mac Geek Gab. We're just in their little drop down list there. It's a pretty short list. And that way they know that we sent you to them. And that's good for everybody. So thanks so much to Gazelle for being our sponsor. Visit them at gazelle.com. All right, John, let's go to Joe. We've got some fun tech questions here. I want to see where these take us. So Joe says, I recently bought a used Mac Pro 4.1 from 2009. About every other day, the fans will just turn on at full speed, usually about a minute after waking up or turning on, and when not even straining the computer. To remedy this, I reset the SMC by unplugging the power cord and waiting 15 seconds, or I turn the fans down with an app while monitoring the temperature of the CPU with menu meters, but I'm pretty nervous when doing that. I was wondering if there's anything I could do to not have to keep unplugging the computer or doing something manual. So, this is interesting because resetting the SMC, that's really smart. That sort of gets the computer back to baseline. I'm curious, though, typically these fans are going to turn on when a temperature, not just the CPU temperature, but a temperature sensor indicates that something is getting too hot. So the question is, what's getting too hot? Menu meters or something like iStat menus show you a lot of different temperature sensors in your computer, not just the CPU. It could be the GPU. It could be something else. And so I'm curious what's happening with the temperature in there. What, you know, if we can figure out what's causing the fans to kick up, maybe we can figure out what's going on. Any thoughts on this, John?
Yeah, I was looking, and as far as I can tell, menu meters does not show you the temperature.
It might just show CPU usage.
I was looking. So it shows CPU, disk, memory, and network traffic. But so iStat menus, hopefully you can run it on a machine that is that old. But what has to be is, or my opinion is that it's a flaky temperature sensor.
Oh,
where you were going. Well, they're
sure
they
happens.
Wear out like anything. I mean, I think basically what it is, it's a little resistor, and based on the value, you know, it tells the computer how warm something is, and the way it reacts if it thinks something is too warm is it spins up the fans.
Sure. Yeah.
The reason I mention that is because we've seen that. I remember for a while the iMacs had this kind of proprietary temperature sensor, and if you didn't install it and it wasn't there, then basically I guess the circuit was open and the computer would interpret that as this thing's burning up, and it would spin up the fans to full speed. So based on that experience, that's why I'm thinking it's a flaky sensor. So yeah, but the way you have to tell is running something like iStat menus. And you'll probably see one, I'm guessing, I'm hoping, that's way off, or is it like the maximum value?
So, you know, this is it, and it's easy to forget this stuff, but PowerBook Dude in the chat room suggests bringing it to the Genius Bar where troubleshooting happens for free. And they will run Apple's extended diagnostics on this, and that will check all of the temperature sensors for free. I believe this computer is still supported by the Genius Bar. It's going to be close, but I believe it's still supported by the Genius Bar. That's the only question that I would have about it.
What did he say? It was a 2009?
2009. Yeah, it's going to be on the...
Which
it's
one?
Gonna be on the fence. Yeah, 2009 4.1 Mac Pro. So that's the question: is it is it not considered a legacy machine yet? And I don't, it's going to be close, but it's worth.
Mac Tracker says vintage.
So vintage, not legacy. I think if it's vintage, the diagnostic still runs.
Correct. It's not obsolete. The one before that, so the early 2008, according to Mac Tracker, is obsolete. Vintage, I think, means support's almost gone.
But this is an important thing to remember, that Apple's stores, not the ASPs, the kind of the individually owned Apple partners, will charge you for diagnostics, as they should, because they're spending their valuable time helping you. Apple's Genius Bar chooses not to charge for that valuable diagnostic time, which sort of screws the ASPs. But as a consumer, if you can get yourself to a Genius Bar and get an appointment in a time frame and distance that works for you, you can save a little bit of money by having Apple do those diagnostics for free. They won't do the repair for free, although oftentimes their repairs will be. When I had to get my power supply replaced in this iMac, it was cheaper to have Apple replace it, and probably cheaper to have my local ASP replace it, than it was to buy the part from iFixit. And then I would, of course, had to put it in myself. And it's just because Apple, other than their ASPs, Apple does not. And when I say ASP, I mean authorized service providers. Their ASPs can buy hardware, like parts, direct from Apple. No one else can. So places like iFixit or Tech Restore or anything like that, they have to buy parts in bulk from liquidators. And sometimes it's Apple liquidating stuff by selling off, a lot of 100,000 bad iPhones, and then they take them apart and pull the good pieces out and things like that. So so that's why those parts are expensive on the aftermarket. So, yeah, but I'm with you, John. Yeah, trying to figure out what temperature sensor it is. And then that might tell you it's a bad sensor, or, there's some other component that is actually heating up. So another listener, John, we've had there's so many Johns. These are the Johns I know, asks, like you, I'm a bit of a speed and throughput junkie when it comes to my internet connection, and I wanted to get your opinion about bonded cable modems. I noticed that DOCSIS 3.1 is starting to make its way to the consumer market, and I'm writing to you to get your opinion on this. I always listen with interest when you bring up the subject of cable modems, routers, and general networking. About a month ago, unfortunately, I don't remember when, I listened when you went over channel bonding with some cable modems you were testing. Unfortunately, I don't remember if those were 3.1. I have a DOCSIS 3.0 cable modem provided to me by my service provider. It's a Cisco unit with a built-in Wi-Fi and 4-port router. I disabled the Wi-Fi in favor of my aftermarket Netgear R7000 router. However, unfortunately, this modem does not allow me to disable its router, forcing me into a double NAT scenario. Consequently, I find it so far impossible to externally access my QNAP-hosted Plex server, and I'm always on the lookout for better tech to replace my aging stuff. Which modem would you recommend, and do you have any experience with DOCSIS 3.1? So I haven't messed with any 3.1 modems yet, and there's some good discussion. We can put some links in the show notes over at dslreports.com. It's a great place to go to find people talking about all this kind of stuff. I am there quite often. Here's the thing. DOCSIS 3.1 it uses a new signaling protocol, a different QAM, and I can't remember what QAM stands for, but it essentially increases the density of the streams, if you will. I think I'm getting that mostly right, allowing you to send more data over existing channels. Most providers are not yet supporting DOCSIS 3.1. You would need it for gigabit internet speeds over a cable, a coax connection. Comcast is doing some testing. I believe it's only in Nashville right now. They're expanding. It's happening. Within the next year, I expect DOCSIS 3.1 to start to be relatively common in sort of their larger market areas, and then it'll expand beyond that. But here's the thing. DOCSIS 3.0 cable modems are still pretty inexpensive, and you can get really good ones for less than $100. You know, like I really like the Motorola 7420. I like the surfboard. I like the 6900 actually. That's got a router in it, but you can turn the router off. I also tested the Netgear C7000, which is actually a cable modem with your router inside of it. And again, with these that have the ones that I would recommend with routers in them or Wi-Fi access points in them, you can turn those off if and when the technology that's in your router becomes obsolete when it comes to the networking stuff, but not the cable modem stuff. At this point, I would suggest a DOCSIS 3.0 modem because they're cheap. DOCSIS 3.1 modems are just starting to get provider certification. They're still very expensive. There's not many of them on the market. I would argue to say that unless you need a DOCSIS 3.1 modem right now, and if you do, your provider's probably going to provide you with one because this is all very new. But unless you need one right now, I'm assuming the soonest you would need one is probably in a year. So let's say we're talking about having you buy a DOCSIS 3.0 modem right now, and then a year from now, buy again. And really, a cable modem should last you, 4 or 5 years, right? So it would make sense to say, well, I'll buy the 3.1 now. It's all backwards compatible. And then when I need it, it's there. Because of the way the pricing is and because of the way the market is, I think you'd spend less money buying a 3.0 right now and then a 3.1 in a year after their prices come down than you would just buying a 3.1 right now, even if you could buy a 3.1. And I don't think you can. I think you can only get them through the providers at this moment. So spend the, whatever it is, I don't know, I think it's like, $78 or something. Get yourself any one of these. I like the Netgears. I like the surfboards. I like the Motorolas. I would get something that is at least 16x4 right now with kind of the standard home connection. Comcast, which is, one of the larger providers in the U.S. here, will bond up to 20 channels on the downstream if you have them, and typically 3 on the upstream. 16 is enough. The Netgear router I mentioned is a 24x8 router, but still, my Comcast connection bonds 20 down and 3 up on the 24x8 router. On the 16x4, it's obviously 16 down because that's all I've got, and 3 up. But either one of those is more than enough to get what's my connection now? 200 megabits per second down and I think 10 up. So that means 220, 230 down and like 12 up. But I wouldn't buy DOCSIS 3.1 right now, but keep an eye out for it. I mean, it's interesting that, we're pushing gigabit to the home over coax. That's pretty cool. Thoughts, John?
QAM is quadrature amplitude modulation.
You rock. Thank you.
Well, it's easy enough to look up.
Yeah, I think. Right.
But yeah, I've seen it too. I actually see it right now on my DOCSIS screen for all my downstream are all 256 QAM.
Okay.
My upstream, oddly enough, is only DOCSIS 2,
yeah,
which I guess makes sense.
Yeah.
But I guess the first question I'd ask myself before thinking about this is, does your ISP even support it? Because
right,
if you get a 3.1 and they don't support it, then it's not going to go any faster.
Correct. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I'm living in I still have our basic package, which is what, 30 down, I think, and 5 up.
Okay.
Works for me.
Yeah. I will say this. If you are a
not for you, because you're a crazy household, you have like tons of devices. So
I don't know if you'd
survive with 30 down and 5 up.
I would have to go out of my way to have Comcast slow me down to that. No, they're just, their connections are just like, even the baseline connections are just much faster. So because I got this email from John, it actually, then my wife was asking if we could get some of the lights out of the bedroom for a while. We did move the main router up there. And so I did, I moved everything around, but as a byproduct of that, I had to unplug my cable modem because I was moving the cable modem from the bedroom back down to the living room where I prefer to have it. And the reason I can do that now is the bonded Mocha, and I have a great connection between them with those ActionTech devices. So moved the cable modem, and after I moved it, I thought, hey, wait a minute, I should turn off QoS on my router so that nothing's limiting my connection speed. and then run a speed test. And lo and behold, I found that by power cycling my router, it re-downloads the profile that I'm supposed to have from Comcast. And when it did, it bumped up from 150 megabits per second to 200. And I mentioned that, and lots of people then went and rebooted their Comcast routers, and voila, their connection speeds went up. So I had to retweak my QoS settings to, you know, to let me take advantage of that, which I did. And now coming to you over a 200 megabit. Actually, it's about, when I tested it, it's like 225 to 235 is where I get on the downstream, and then still the 10 megabit upstream. So that's like really 12 and a half. But it works great. Remember to reboot your cable modems is the point, especially if you're a Comcast customer, because sometime in the last month, they began upgrading people nationwide. It's not just here in New England that I'm hearing about.
Okay, hold on. Let me try that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Our service, our basic service, which it's about $50 a month.
Okay.
And I think I get a discount because I also get. But yeah, Optimum, a while ago, they wanted like a pat on the back because they increased their lowest tier from 25 megabits down to 30 megabits down.
And sure. It's
like, wow, thanks for throwing me that extra crumb. That's really going to make a big difference.
So
when I'm looking at people like you, where I imagine you have above basic tier, but still.
Only one level above basic.
Oh,
and this is all we've ever had. So we've never changed our cable speed, our internet speed package. And we've been in this house 11 and a half years. When we got here, the package that I paid for was the one notch up faster than basic. And that was 12 down and one up. And all that's happened in that time is every now and then Comcast bumps it up and I restart my cable modem and we get more speed. So yeah, it's just, you know, they've really kept up with it. You know, remember they're nationwide, so they have to compete with things beyond just a local area. Like I think your issue is that your provider only focuses on that one area of the country. And so they don't have,
they're pretty much the only game in town for cable.
Right.
Modem. I could get 18, you know, I could get DSL or I don't even think I can get fiber.
Right. Well, that's
despite the thing. There being a big honking fiber something
across the street.
Yeah. No, like I can see it from my window here. There's some big company that's running like, I think, Big Boy fiber.
Yeah.
Because I tried calling them a couple times and like no one answered. And
right.
I looked them up and it's like, yeah. So, yeah, I think ours offers like a boost, but come on, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Real speeds. Yeah. I can't get fiber here, but I believe Portsmouth can, and Portsmouth is about 10 minutes from me, but we're in the same, you know, Comcast service area. So I think that's part of it. And plus Comcast, you know, has a major headquarters in Boston. So we tend to get a lot of stuff first here, which is great. Although we don't have DOCSIS 3.1 yet. We don't have bandwidth caps yet either, which is interesting. So other areas of the country are starting to get those.
Heard Comcast. Some people are starting to shake their fists, rightfully so, because last I checked, bandwidth there's no shortage of it.
Right. So I'm going to point something out, and I'm hoping Comcast isn't listening, but if they are, it's okay. Because I went and tested all these cable modems, right? You know, I just had to keep putting cable modems on my account and it expires off the old ones. I think you can only have like three on your account at any one time. But when you add a new one, it just, you know, it's a first in, first out kind of thing. For whatever reason, though, even though we don't have bandwidth caps, Comcast has their bandwidth meters running so that you can see how much bandwidth you're using. And I am officially using zero because whatever cable modem Comcast system has decided is the one it should track is not the one that I am using. And you know, like I said, there's three or four of them, whatever the number is, currently allowed and activated on my account right now. But, I guess I added enough in a short period of time that it kind of confused the system. So right now I'm sort of living outside of Comcast's guidelines or Comcast meters, I should say. I expect that will change at some point, but, you know, I share that for just nuggets of information for you to all share. So there you go. Fun stuff. I'm glad. Thank you for asking about that, John. It's good.
Yeah, so I can get, so they got 60, 100, 200, and 300 are the other options that are available. I guess they don't
know. How much more, do you get, is it obvious how much more you would have to pay to get up to 100? No. Okay.
No, I mean, dude, why would you show the price of something on the same page that shows the features? I mean, come on.
Dude, tell me about it. It's a cable company. I get the same thing with Comcast. Yeah. You know, while we're talking about Comcast, though, I do want to say that I hear a lot about a lot of people that have had problems with Comcast nationwide. I see it, you know, they're treated like the, you know, the devils of the internet, the bane of people's existence. I have had Comcast for 11 years, as I mentioned. I have had a stellar experience with them. Their customer support has been top notch for me. And I don't believe that I'm getting any special treatment or anything like that. If I have to call customer support or I have to contact customer support, I use their live chat. Now, I realize there's times when you can't use their live chat if your internet's down. But the people that are on the live chat know what they're talking about, are able to help, and are really, really good. So, like I said, I've had a stellar experience with Comcast. I know that, you know, there are others that have not. But I highly recommend using their live chat for anything, not just internet stuff, TV stuff, billing, whatever it is. The live chat people are on point and it's really, really good. So I just wanted to, maybe using live chat is the trick. That's typically how I talk to them. I will say that when I've had to call on the phone, like for TiVo related stuff or whatever it is, the main customer service is awful. But now I have the, I don't know if it's secret, but I don't think it is because they gave it to me. But I have the special number to call just for TiVo stuff. And once you get somebody that knows what they're talking about, you're fine. And I think that's part of the benefit of live chat, too, with Comcast is they're able to get you to who they need to get you to without driving you crazy with, you know, phone trees. So anyway, just wanted to point that out. While we're on the subject, another John listener has a question about Wi-Fi. Says my current home Wi-Fi setup is as follows. I have Comcast internet, but no phone or TV, an airport time capsule main base station, an airport extreme router connected by Ethernet to the main base station, but acts as an extender. We'll talk about that in a minute. An Apple TV fourth gen also connected via Ethernet. Many Internet of Things things, Hue bulbs, an August lock, Kuna lights, iDevices objects, a Nest thermostat, and a Nest Protect. I have essentially three networks going. A 2.4 gigahertz network, a 5 gigahertz network, and a guest network called NetGuest. All of my IoT things are linked to the NetGuest, so it's not really used specifically as a guest network. It's just compartmentalized. We have a variety of computers, iPads, and phones around the house as well. About 2 months ago, I upgraded my Comcast service to 150. Now you're at 200. Indeed, when I subsequently performed speed tests using the online test as well as the iOS app Net Analyzer, Wi-Fi speeds were in excess of 150 on all three networks. About 3 weeks ago, I noticed that when my iPad was connected to the 2.4 network, it seemed a little sluggish. Indeed, when I analyzed it, the download speeds barely reached 50 megabits. But when I connected to the Net5 or NetGuest networks, the download speeds were back at the 150 plus speeds. I confirmed this with both web-based and app-based tests. I've tried resetting my base station network with no luck. Any suggestions? Yeah, that actually sounds about right to me, John. In general, 2.4 isn't going to hit all the crazy maximums that we define, right? For a 2.4 gigahertz network, which is a 3x3:3 MIMO, which is, I believe, what Apple is using on your version of the time capsule and Airport Extreme, that gives a theoretical maximum of 450 megabits per second. It's 150 per stream, and that device supports three 2.4 gigahertz streams simultaneously. But that's 450 megabits at 40 megahertz channel bandwidth, and Apple's devices don't support that. And nor should they. 2.4 gigahertz networks should only be using 20 megahertz channel bandwidth. And that's what Apple does. You can't change it. On some third-party routers, you can't. So now we're at half that, 216.7 megabits per second. It's actually a little bit less than half due to some overhead. 2.4 gigahertz networks usually perform in the real world at a maximum of about half of the supported bandwidth, although that's not always the case. So now we're down to 108.35. That's the routine maximum you'll get on a 3x3:3 MIMO 2.4 gigahertz, 20 megahertz network. Too many numbers? Yes. You might get a little faster at times, but the conditions have to be stellar. So if you were getting better than that, it's likely that the conditions have changed or a firmware update changed something. Your iPad, depending on what model it is, your iPad, though, might only support 2x2 MIMO, meaning two streams at a time. So it's not even going to use the maximum of your router, depending on the model. And then, of course, that cuts the bandwidth down. Generally speaking, with Apple devices in particular, I find it best to name both my 2.4 and 5 gigahertz networks the same, and let the device decide which network is best. But sometimes the device will get it wrong. But my guess is that you're just seeing the difference between speed capabilities of 2.4 and 5 gigahertz networks. So I think that's normal. Any thoughts on this, John?
I'm wondering if it eventually would have switched over to the, if to the faster speed. I mean, most Apple devices do that.
No, that's not how Apple devices. No, Apple devices will pick. Apple devices use that priority list. As long as security is the same, it will go by your priority list that you can't reorganize on your iOS devices, but you can on your Mac if you're syncing with iCloud. So whatever's at the top of that list is what it's going to choose if it sees it. And then the second on the list, you know, if it can't see the first one. So, yeah, it's not.
Oh, if you're separating them. OK,
if you're separating them. Yes, yes, yes. Right. Which he has. Right. He's
which naming. He has.
Yeah.
OK.
Yeah. No, you're right. Otherwise, it'll pick the right one. Yes.
You know, I wish there was a tool, but, you know, I use something called Dabuki Tools.
Yeah.
Dabuki Tools. And that's cool because that actually shows. So when I roam around the house with sense of purpose, not just aimlessly. Right. Sure. But I'll notice that it'll sometimes show, hey, I'm going, typically when I get closer to my AC base, it'll be like, hey, I'm switching to 5 gigs. How's that? And I'm like, cool. Oh, right. I'm going to make a wider channel.
Sure.
No, it's fun to watch that. I wish there was a similar thing to show you exactly what's happening on the iOS side.
Right. Right.
But you're right. In this case, it wouldn't apply because it's going to lock on to one or the other.
It's going to lock on. Yeah. Yeah. I would, in your case, I would, in listener John's case, I would name them the same unless you have reason not to. And then I've actually been experimenting with this. So I've got all my networks named the same. And then on a couple of my routers here, I've added a hidden SSID so that I can always connect devices to 5 gigahertz or 2.4 just to do some experimenting because, you know, we've got to be able to talk about this stuff. And so I have all my iOS devices now locked onto my 5 gigahertz network by name. And it's actually worked out quite well, but I have good coverage of 5 gigahertz here. The issue would be if you have only one router or one access point, I should say, and you're kind of at the edge of where that might be. You need to do your speed testing and see, you know, what's it like if I'm just connected to the 5 gigahertz and I'm as far away as I'll ever be, but yet still seeing the 5 gigahertz connection. Because remember, 5 doesn't go as far as 2.4. It'll be faster because you're doing, on many of these devices, you're doing 802.11ac. So you've just got, you know, massively wide bandwidth. That whole QAM thing that we talked about before, QAM, that's what AC is really taking advantage of, is just higher density on those connections. And so you just need to do a speed test and find out. Like, even when you have a crummy 5 gigahertz connection, if you're using AC, what does that net you? And if the answer is way faster than the 2.4 that seems stronger, well, then stick with the 5, as long as it holds the connection. So, I'm finding that if you've got good coverage, splitting your network names can actually be okay. I don't know if it's, again, I don't know that it's mandatory, but it can be okay. So, and then we get to Andrew's question, John, unless there's more here on John's.
The other thing I noticed flipping through, which I didn't know this, but now I know it now, and I'm going to share it with you. But actually, it appears that some of the iPads, specifically the mini, are still only N. The latest is AC, but some of the older iPad minis that aren't too old.
Yeah.
The iPad mini 3 and prior have N.
That's right. Yeah.
So I don't know if that's the specific iPad in question. That could also explain why you're not getting as good.
I mean, 2.4 would be, N is as good as it's going to get there. But on 5 right. gigahertz. Yeah. And that's what you need to kind of look at is, it's a very good point. If some of your devices, remembering that all of your Apple devices are going to share the same priority list, you kind of have to think a little bit about that. What you could do, again, if your router supports it, is set up an AC only network where your router will not let anything other than 802.11 AC clients connect to 5 gigahertz, and then prioritize that, and then your 2.4 below that. And that way, you know, if you've got these like John just pointed out, you know, a 5 gigahertz device on N probably is better off at further range doing 2.4. But a 5 gigahertz device on 802.11 AC is probably better at long range than doing 2.4. So you can set it so that your router will only allow devices to connect to 5 gigahertz at AC. That might actually be a good way to do it. And I think you could even do that on Apple's routers, right? You can limit what the 5 gigahertz connection is. And that actually would be, the more I think about it, that would probably be a smart thing to do, because 5 gigahertz 802.11n it can be wonky, you know, because it's you're using this kind of older signaling protocol over something where your connection quality is generally not going to be great because 5 gigahertz doesn't blast through walls all that well. Huh. That's interesting. We need to try that. Yeah. That's kind of the thing.
I've actually, on my non-Apple router, I've actually excluded, I think I turned off 802.11b because nobody should be using that.
Sure.
So that's just like dark ages of Wi-Fi.
Right. Well, but you might wind up with some older device. Like if you've got an old printer or something.
I won't permit it. Nope.
That's right. Nope. No more printing.
Nope. The only other thing I want to consider is I was thinking the other day, so my MacBook Pro has only 802.11n. Mm-hmm. There actually is a company that makes a replacement module that'll do AC.
An internal module.
Yeah, I mean, it's a standard, you know, I think it's a Broadcom chip.
Sure. But not an external thing. You just put it inside.
I already have an external thing, the bare extender. I have that. And that's fine. That's USB 3. And, you know, that if there's a situation where I want to get slightly higher speeds,
yeah,
then I plug that in. But it'd be nice to replace the internal board just for fun. So I was thinking is, you know, where are all my devices? I mean, just going through them. I'm all like, you know what? My portable isn't AC, although my mini is, but my mini is wired.
Right.
So I hardly ever use the wireless on it.
Right. All right. I want to get to Andrew's question here because it's very much related. He says, this is one thing that gives me the heebie-jeebies about the Apple Watch. I love it otherwise. I run a dual wireless network, 2.4 and 5 gigahertz, with different SSIDs for the 2 and 5 networks. Why? Because microwaves and cordless phones interfere with 2.4 and stuff up the streaming of my music and video. Okay, fair point. So he doesn't want his devices to connect to 2.4 if they don't have to. So all of my iOS and macOS devices only run on my 5 gigahertz network, so I get an unbroken stream. I have edited out the 2.4 gigahertz connection on all devices, so it's not on his list. It's not being shared with iCloud and not being shared with his watch. He says, that's great, but my Apple Watch only runs on 2.4 gigahertz. So because none of my iOS devices connect to 2.4, my watch does not know about the 2.4 gigahertz network and therefore doesn't try to connect to it. It only uses Bluetooth rather than Wi-Fi to communicate with my phone. If the watch is out of Bluetooth range, it doesn't interact with the phone at all because there's no Wi-Fi connection. If both were on 2.4, there would be no problem as the watch would communicate over Wi-Fi. So I put the phone on wireless 2.4, or he says maybe that would be the advice you give. But then the connection is shared with all my other Apple devices automatically, and they may kick onto 2.4 without my knowledge. I looked at the Series 2 Apple Watch, hoping it would run 5 gigahertz, and it won't. And then there's the power requirements, I believe, is the reason there. Any suggestions apart from a fish shake at Apple? Yeah. So my first question, and you may have already tried this, but have you tried running the same SSID for both? I mean, it sounds like you've very intentionally tested this and found that when you are running the same SSID for both, things wind up choosing 2.4 and then getting this interference. But that would be worth testing because Apple devices are usually pretty good at selecting the best network for them. But with different SSID names, you should be able to use the priority list, as we mentioned, to get what you want. Go on your iCloud connected Mac into System Preferences, Network, Wi-Fi, Advanced, and then also Wi-Fi, and rearrange your preferred network so that your 5 gigahertz network is up at the top and your 2.4 gigahertz network is below that, based on what we just talked about, where Apple chooses the first network if it can see it. It should do exactly what you want because your watch won't be able to see the 5 gigahertz network. It'll fall back to the 2.4. Your phone, what happened when you added the 2.4 gigahertz network to your phone, it put it higher up in the priority list than the other networks it knew about. And that, I believe, was your problem. So if you do it on your Mac first and set the priority list there and then let that propagate down, I think you're going to get what you want. I think you will. Thoughts on this, John, before we move on? I think we've got time for a couple more. Okay. I hope. You would hope. Yeah.
That is interesting, though. I would think the reason they only have 2.4 gig radios in there is just because.
It's just because. Yeah. Well, no, I think there's.
Because Bluetooth is also on 2.4.
Right. Gig, so we can share the antenna. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think it's just
efficiency.
I mean, they could put a 5 gig radio in there if they wanted to, but
I think it would use more battery power. I think I seem to remember power requirements for 5 being higher.
That sounds reasonable.
Sweet. All right, we've got a couple of tips to go through here. So let's get those, and we'll start with Paul's because we've been talking about Wi-Fi. We might as well get there. He says, on the back of your recent discussion about hidden Wi-Fi networks, one thing your listeners might like to know is that if they use an Amazon Alexa device, either the Echo or Dot, Amazon will by default store your Wi-Fi network password on their servers. This info is buried in the Alexa settings. In the Alexa app, go to Settings, Alexa Devices, Name Echo Dot, Wi-Fi Network Saved to Amazon. Your password won't be stored on Amazon servers if it's an enterprise network password, a hidden network, or an open network not secured with a password because there's no password to store. The app says Wi-Fi passwords are stored so, quote, we can configure your compatible devices so that you won't need to re-enter your Wi-Fi passwords on each device, end quote. Nice of Amazon to ask. I thought this was a little sneaky myself and possibly a good reason to hide your SSID after all. You're right. I will say I just set up one of the new Gen 2 Amazon Echo Dots. The thing's awesome, by the way. It's like what you would want Siri to actually be in your house. We've got it in the kitchen right now, and it's stellar. We can get all kinds of information. I can have it turn on my TV. It's outstanding. But it did ask, or it did tell me that it was going to store my passwords in Amazon's cloud, my Wi-Fi password. So, Yeah. I was aware of this before I got Paul's email, but that may be an update that they did, you know, between when Paul set his up and when I set mine up. So, yeah, but a hidden network wouldn't do it. So.
And I think I got a mini tip. I think Allison said something about this, our friend Allison at the NoSillaCast. Her device was telling her the weather in a town that she didn't live in. And as it turns out, I think you have to manually set this because I think what it does is it tries to geolocate your IP address. And sometimes that doesn't necessarily work out to be the location you're in. Like, for example, Optimum operates in Connecticut and also Long Island.
Sure.
So sometimes when I go to certain sites, they'll be like, hey, welcome from Long Island. And I'm like, nope.
No.
Huh. Sometimes my IP comes out to be one that,
sure,
as far as they know, is in Long Island. But
right.
It's not.
Right. It's not. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that makes sense. I believe that. Yeah, yeah.
Did you? Me and you, well, I don't know if you have that problem.
I think it asked me what my address was when I went through the setup. Yeah, yeah. Because I remember giving it, like, my address, or it asking, because it, you know, it's linked to my Amazon account, so Amazon has a lot of information about me. I think I was able to either pick or tell it my actual address, and then it works. I've had a lot of fun with the Echo. The Farfield voice is really amazing. It's what's cool is it's got a ring around the top that lights up when you talk to it. But it lights up like blue, but then you get a dark blue dot on the side of the, or on the edge of the ring, kind of facing where your voice has come from. So the thing is, it obviously really able to tell what, you know, where you are and what direction you're coming from on this thing. And that whole Farfield voice thing that they've got going on is really interesting. It knows what direction you're coming from and really narrows it down. It's that whole, you know, kind of that concept of beam forming that Wi-Fi does. They're doing with, audio waves. I mean, it responds right away. I mean, all I have to say is, you know, Alexa, and I know a lot of you now have devices that are blue and responding in weird ways because it thinks that I'm talking to it, but I'm not. Alexa, thank you. And then that'll shut it up. So there you go. Scott has, he's got a little audio comment from last show. So we'll from our final discussion on last show. And then we've got one more tip at least to go through here.
Hey, Sean and Dave, this is Scott in D.C. How's this for timely? I'm almost caught up, and I'm listening to Mackie Gab number 628. Let me bring your discussion about denial of service attacks down to a basic level. I don't have to request the web page for you. I could basically do the electronic equivalent of knocking on your door. When TCP makes a request saying, hi, I'm going to come in and talk to you, it basically sends a knock, basically what we call a SYN packet, synchronous. That's what SYN stands for, synchronous, to start a conversation. All I have to do is flood you with a bunch of those SYN packets. That's called the SYN flood. You can do a number of other things. What the IoT things did was leverage a couple of bugs within this particular device that's been going around. To basically go out and say, okay, I need for you to call me at this address to give you your status. Okay, so what's the address? Well, here's the URL. What's the URL? Basically, at this point, you're going to unleash all that data and send it out to Dyn and attack Dyn. Why were they able to attack Dyn? Because the DNS query is not a TCP message. It's a UDP message. UDP is the datagram protocol. It's basically saying, I'm going to throw a packet out there, and it's going to get there. It may get there. I'm going to wait for answer back. While TCP simulates a connection, UDP doesn't. And because the DNS queries are so small and so short, basically what the concept was is you throw the packet out there, you wait a certain amount of time, you get an answer back, and you go from there. Well, what these guys did instead was not only tell the particular IoT devices, and some of them were routers too. There are a number of routers that were in their home routers that have this bug, is say, okay, I need you to go to this particular address. Here's the URL. Oh, well, as any good computer does, where's the URL? Oh, it has to call the DNS service, domain name service, to say, okay, translate this to an IP address. Translate to an IP address means pack up the query in a packet, send it to UDP port 53 at the service. No sync flood, no connection, no nothing. Just throw the packet. Well, guess what? You get about 1,000 of these to throw the packet. You throw the packet. You form it just right, And what you do is you tell it to return the answer to another one. Well, when the other device gets it, it doesn't know what to do.
And that's how it. And that's how the flood happened. So very. Thank you, Scott, for that. It's good stuff. Very, very interesting. So, thoughts on that, John? Before we move on to our final tip.
I think the router should all be reprogrammed to stop this sort of thing.
Dude,
you wrote something.
I did. This is the most obvious thing, right? We are going to have these devices in our homes that are compromisable. And here's the deal. And I haven't written this up yet, but I will. HomeKit is not the answer. HomeKit's awesome when it comes to its own security. I mean, it's like so awesome that it's probably too much. Okay. Like there are devices that their CPUs can't handle HomeKit. Because it's like totally bleeding edge security. It's like 3072 bit keys all exchanged over this elliptical curve thing. So it's constantly changing. And it like key exchange with this, there's some devices that when they did initial tests took 40 seconds just to get to the point where they were ready to authenticate with each other. This is like hyper security. That's not a bad thing, by the way. That's speaking volumes about how secure HomeKit is. And frankly, how almost, I'm not going to say anything is not unhackable, but if anything's unhackable, it's HomeKit. Okay. Very, very secure, but that's it. You can't hack into the HomeKit stream, but there is nothing in the HomeKit spec. And I have talked with hardware vendors about this. There is nothing in the HomeKit spec that says that they cannot allow other access methods. Okay. And this is proven, right? You can have HomeKit devices, HomeKit compatible devices that also have their own iOS app to talk directly to them or whatever. But even if HomeKit were the only protocol used on an IP-based device, it could still have this exact same SSH hole that was used to exploit the other devices in the attack recently. I have confirmed this with multiple IoT vendors. And so, this is a thing. It's just HomeKit's not the magic answer. So we need to have an environment where a compromised device can't keep doing all of these things. And your router in your home is perfectly suited to do this because it knows what type of device it is based on the MAC address, or at least it knows the vendor. And if it sees a device sending lots and lots of DNS queries to something that is not its normal DNS server, the corporate firewalls already do this stuff, right? They're constantly looking for anomalies. The routers that we have in our homes have really fast processors on them because we need them to do QoS. Well, what do you think QoS is doing? It's looking at every packet and deciding what to do with it and how to prioritize it. No reason we couldn't add an algorithm to all those home routers that are already doing QoS or should be Apple. And have it at least flag this traffic, if not slow it down. And you could even whitelist stuff or blacklist stuff, right? If Dyn's being attacked, push out an update to routers that says, all right, yep, stop this. I don't know. To me, that's the easiest. And it's not easy. Somebody needs to write the software, but the devices already exist in many of our homes to limit this down. You need to put a speed bump in the way for people. And I think the router is the way to do it. Thank you for reminding me of that, John. Good stuff. I don't know. Any other thoughts?
More than you could possibly imagine, but nothing about this.
All right. Well, I think that's going to be enough because we're already there. You know, it's just
seems
how
like
goes.
We just started.
I know. It's been a fun one. Good stuff. If you want to contact us, if you have anything to say, comments, questions, cool stuff found, tips, whatever it might be, email us feedback@macgeekab.com.
I'm not sure if I heard you right. I thought you said feedback@macgeekab.com.
I did. I said feedback@macgeekab.com, unless you're a premium subscriber. And then you get to email us at premium@macgeekab.com, where we give you first priority when we're going through all our notes and such. You can also call us. Any of you can call us at 224-888-GEEK. And John, Geek is?
4-3-3-5. And you know, we haven't mentioned it for a while, but there's this thing that's still out there called Twitter. I'm John F. Ron. He's Dave Hamilton. The podcast is Mac Geek App. Publication is Mac Observer. All on Twitter.
I do want to thank our premium members, John. And yeah, we'd love to see you on Twitter. Twitter is fun. We put up some fun little surveys there to keep everything going. I want to thank our premium members that wrote in or that we talked about in this episode. That's Chuck early on. First question about Sierra. John asked about the Touch ID keyboard. John, different John, asked about managing Wi-Fi speeds. Andrew asked about his watch. And Paul alerted us to Amazon's storing of our Wi-Fi passwords. Thank you so much, for all of you and everyone who's a premium subscriber, for supporting the show and really, really helping us continue to do what we do. It means a ton. If you want to learn about premium, visit us at MacGeekGab.com. You can learn all about it right there. I also want to thank CashFly at CACHEFLY.com for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes our great sponsors. Of course, we mentioned Gazelle in this episode at gazelle.com. The folks at Fat Cat Software at fatcatsoftware.com/MGG, where you can get a coupon on power photos. Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek. Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Otherworld Computing at macsales.com. Barebones Software at barebones.com. Casper, casper.com/MGG. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for contributing. Thank you for all that you do. We love that we are able to continue to do this. And don't get caught.
Made up.